Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, April 19th, 2018 meeting of the General Plan Advisory Committee. We have a quorum. We are missing Rich Bouquet today. And we are now called to order. We'll start with a moment of silence. And since we're in a rush today, we'll move right along to the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you. Are there any GPAC announcements? Any presentations? We have none. We do have a public comment period, and I see people in the public. Does anybody want to come and speak?
My name is Jim Reed. I live at 315 Bernardo Avenue. I've lived there for 18 years. And what I want to talk about is vacation rentals. I've had a chance to briefly review the new ordinance changes that are out, including some of the minor things like calling R1 zones RS zones now. So I'm referred to that briefly. My first position would be that ideally there shouldn't be any short-term vacation rentals in these zones. Other communities have stopped them entirely. Carmel has, I think Shell Beach, from what I understand, has. An alternative possibility might be to have home-hosted rentals with the homeowner on the property and so forth in those zones. But if that's not on the table, the salient points that I feel are important is the physical distance between these rentals needs to be looked at by code enforcement. And they should be no closer than 200 feet from closest property line to the closest property line. Currently licensed short-term rentals should not be grandfathered in and allowed to continue, because oftentimes there are many of them, particularly in Morro Bay Heights and Upland Beachcomber, that are well within that, and they're non-conforming probably in other ways. So these to remain and just be grandfathered in, as I think is proposed in the new ordinance, I think just takes the teeth out of everything. I think another thing that needs to be looked at is the proposal to transfer a current license from the house seller to the house itself when a new buyer buys it. I think the license should be in the name of the person and not the house. And when the house is sold, that license should revert to the city and be issued to somebody on the waiting list that meets the rules of the new ordinance. The city is going to need better code enforcing than it has now, because the spacing alone is a problem. If you look, for instance, up in on Beachcomber, there'll have to be somebody to actually verify these spaces. Sometimes they're a lot farther apart, sometimes they're closer. Additionally, there needs to be an effort by the city council to determine how many unlicensed rentals we have. There are a bunch of them. Everyone talks about that. No one really knows how many they are. There must be a way to find this out and to, if they're found, to be able to put a stop to it. And another thing which is being looked at by, I just recently reviewed the Carpinteria rules and a few other places, fines need to be realistically set and enforced, because at this point, these properties are getting $500-$600 or more a night, and there's no incentive for a property owner of one of these to be hit with a $125 fine or something. I think one that's being proposed for Pismo is the first one being a $750 fine after a warning, the next one to be $1,000, and the last time revocation of the license. I mean, that's strict, but what's the point of having an ordinance if you don't enforce it? So a lot of people feel very strongly about this. In fact, I thought there would be a lot more people here today. I know this is coming up at the city council meeting next week, but these are just my general thoughts, and I've discussed them with a few people here. But that's my input for the moment.
Thanks, Jim. That's good input.
Good afternoon, Bill Martin, Emoro Bay. Couple comments in the past. I know when we've been talking about the zoning updates, I have talked to different, I think it was the joint planning harbor as far as the harborfront zoning, and this is primarily south of the boat launch. It's called Special Planning Area B. It's an area that has a special overlay on it now. And I've been told two things, and I'm a little confused. First off, I was told that they were talking about the working waterfront allowing anything from commercial to offshore oil energy support to, you know, just almost everything but the kitchen sink. They even said, like, military, which I know they meant the Coast Guard in this area. The actual special planning area actually says recreational fishing and boating, and new commercial fishing should go up into the Measure D area. And yet, last planning commission, Scott, I think you mentioned that everything was going to stay the same down there. So I guess the question is special planning area B, the wording, going to stay the same, or is that going to go away and the new zoning that you're talking about in the working waterfront going to overlay that area? It's primarily residential now. There's a little thin, maybe a 30-foot wide strip of waterfront commercial, and which is, with the setbacks, is almost unusable. But in this area, most of it's R1. And secondly, it is also, there's about 28 homes there, and there's one little boatyard. So the waterfront commercial is almost non-existent. But I guess the question getting back would be, if it's going to stay the same with the special planning area B, or if that's being eliminated and the working waterfront, the general plan is going down in that area, because it really won't fit. The second thing, I might be behind the curve, but I have a map from Chevron on their properties that they're selling, you know, from Toro Creek and all around Morro Bay. On their information, they're showing a lot of R1 and visitor-serving commercial. And I wasn't sure if that's what the city's proposing or this is just kind of their sales pitch saying that it may happen. This is currently zoned ag in the county. Ag in the county allows for one residence in the ag zoning and in support buildings. So you would be extremely upgrading or up zoning the Chevron property should you include it in the city and allow the R1 zoning. And the visitors serving down by Toro Creek would totally change that landscape. So if that's what the city's proposing, it would be a massive change to that area and your hills behind Morro Bay. If it's just going to stay in the county with maybe future annexation, but with the county ag zoning, then it will keep it right to a minimum. So that's the two things. And then I think the last thing I want to mention is I think I heard about zoning going up to 44 feet in the downtown area. If you look at San Luis Obispo, I know other people have talked about it, they're forming canyons in San Luis Obispo. And if you want a little fishing village, you don't have single stories that are 16 feet tall. That's more like your Costco-type buildings. So I think if you keep the current 30 feet, you're going to keep more of the character. If you go up to 44 feet, you're going to be looking like, you know, San Luis Obispo for that. So I just would recommend keeping with the current heights in the, you know, in that area. So thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Anybody else? No. I wanted to share, I got a phone call just before coming down here from Betty Winholtz, and she couldn't make it. And I said I would give her responses to the zoning update here. Her concern, she felt it was a bit generic, so that it didn't sound quite specific to Morro Bay and Morro Bay's character and nature. She was concerned that moving between the tables with the various codes and new codes was kind of convoluted, a little bit difficult to follow. I know I just made myself a little cheat sheet with a post-it note, and that may be something we all get used to, and yet then I guess we'd be asking who's the audience for this. So is it, if it's the planning department and they all get it so they know they can share the same consistent information with the customer who's coming in who wants to do something, that's one use and is really important. If it's also something we want you know, the person, average person, be able to pick up and say, well, I want to buy this lot in this part of town. Just how does it fit in and to what uses? There may be, you know, Betty felt there was a need to make that a little more clear. And then she had something about single-family resident zones. She was concerned with single-family homes going into areas with denser housing allowed. So I think perhaps her idea or goal would be, if it's going to be an area that allows more housing units, that you don't allow the single-family residences in there. So, and this is her opinion, not necessarily mine. I don't mind a community that has a little mix going on. But I said I would share, so I did.
Is it appropriate to respond?
I think we could, if Scott has anything, and then if any of the members.
Sure. First speaker's comments, Jim Reed. We have the buffer in there right now at 200 feet, so that's what we placed it at. We have to allow them in residential zones. If they don't, Coastal won't certify it. They won't let us outlaw it. I went through this process when I was in Pismo, and we tried to specifically City of Pismo Beach operates out of two zoning codes right now, which is fun. It's a 7,000 person city, and so one of the codes we had been at an interpretation that they weren't allowed in residential zones, and so that was kind of where we sat when I was still there, and that was almost 4 years ago now when I left, and when we tried to make it explicit in there so people weren't buying homes and thinking that they could make them vacation rentals, Coastal said, no, you can't outlaw them here in the code. You have to allow them in the residential zones. If you want to, specifically in residential zones that are adjacent to the waterfront, so that was not okay. They said, we're fine if you put buffers in and you want to regulate how they're used and parking and number of occupants and those types of things. They were fine with that. And so you see those types of things in the proposed ordinance. The fines, we have a fine structure that's actually in, and we can talk about this more as we get into this, but in the Chapter 5.47, one of the things we'd probably want to get input from you all on would be, you know, whether you want us to have the vacation rental policies bifurcated and located in two different sections, like one of the municipal code, one in Chapter 5 and one in Chapter 17, or do you want us to take all of them, wrap them in, and put them into the zoning code? I'd be curious on input from that later. The fine structure in this is much less. It's like it's a warning, like 250, 500, hearing to revoke. So Pismo's is much stricter, what they're proposing to come out with. Some of the things they're proposing to come out with has been policies have been shot down by the Coastal Commission in Santa Cruz recently, I think at their last meeting, actually. So they're not probably going to be taking some of those things forward, meaning having the requirement to have on-site persons there, that type of thing. Coastal wasn't really super fired up with City of Santa Cruz's ordinance that had that in there, so I don't know that we'd be able to go down that road if that were the desire of this body. The verifying distance, this is all done by GIS and mapping. We put buffers on it, shows us the map. It's pretty easy to, you know, to look at. So from a code enforcement standpoint, it's not much of an issue. We actually don't get very many complaints about vacation rentals in town, other than we need to have an ordinance that doesn't allow the concentration of them, which is what we're trying to do here. So I think we're trying to resolve some of the issues that come out now. Bill Martini's comments. I mean, not really sure. We're not proposing to change the uses in that area. The working waterfront working group, and then the joint meeting that we had with the Harbor Advisory Board and the Planning Commission sort of confirmed that. And so it just wanting to have a generalized theme about the working waterfront to be incorporated into this, that's why they were forming what they're doing, and so we'll be working toward that happening moving forward. But I think the uses in this area largely stay the same. I don't think there's any proposal to really change those. What else did he say? What else did he have?
Heights in the downtown, 44 feet.
We're proposing at 37. This board reviewed that. We moved that forward to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission, when they reviewed it, and we're not done with them entirely yet, we'll be coming back to them on that specific item out of Module 2, which is where that height came from. They were okay with the 37 mostly. They weren't too excited Joe Graffia can back me up there, about having the additional height to accommodate screening and those types of things. And so we'll probably be relooking at that as well. One of the things we're going to look at and bring back to them, though, is we have a map that shows what lots could, you know, the specific lots going down Morro Bay Boulevard and then turning and going north on Main. That's primarily where those lots are that we go to 37. It's not all over downtown. It's really a fairly localized area. And looking at which of those lots, what's the potential for those lots redeveloping and going to that height? And so we had a conversation yesterday, literally, about parking, and that would be the constraint. So if we have if we look at it and say you have to use our current parking standards, then probably not very much of it of the 100 plus lots are going to be able to redevelop. If you don't require any parking because it's downtown, and we're going to have a different solution for that, perhaps then more of it could happen, or if you have something in between, which may be where we end up, then maybe it's 40% or 50% or something. But we're looking at that number, and so we're bringing that back to the Planning Commission because they asked for that.
And the Chevron lots.
Chevron lots, thank you. Mm-hmm. Chevron lots, that's an important one. The areas that we propose to include in our future sphere are really two levels of Chevron lots that go up behind Panorama, and they would maintain the same land use, which would be agricultural, allowing a single home on them. I think the GPAC weighed in on, as did the City Council and the Planning Commission, and there was some desire potentially to allow visitor serving use on the property, but not hotels. really looking more toward the possibility of like a campground or something along those lines, and then trails for public use and that type of thing. That was pretty much the extent of it. It was really for preservation purposes. We weren't putting zoning. We're not putting land use on there to develop it. It was really to allow for the preservation to keep. There's two slopes that go up back there behind it, and so there's ridges. And we want to keep housing off of ridges if we can. In fact, ideally, we'd be focusing the development down towards Panorama if we can, if the annexation does take place and we're able to put that in our sphere. So that was kind of the intent behind the conversations that we've had. Hopefully you all remember the same thing, because that's kind of where we've ended up with that Planning Commission and that council as well. Right. So I think that answers most of it.
Yes. Thank you. Susan.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to just to the vacation rental item. I actually think we can give a fair amount of, and I'm not sure if it's requiring on-site, owner on-site, but I think it seems like you'd be able to give more leeway for that and then have some kind of complaint-driven process for revoking or fines for licenses. And I think that if you combine that with the idea that the parking situation shouldn't be any worse than if somebody was living there, what the rules generally are for parking, I think that would probably address a lot of the issues.
But that's somewhat how it's drafted now.
Yeah,
it limits occupancy, to two persons per bedroom plus two additional, and then it requires parking based on bedrooms. I mean, it does a lot of that. Whether you want to have bigger fines and a bigger hammer, my point at this point is it doesn't make a big difference to me, because we don't have a huge issue with compliance out there. But the gentleman that spoke, Mr. Reed, and suggested that we have all of these unregulated ones. We don't. Mm-hmm. We literally don't have them. We have 250 registered vacation rentals. I talk to some of those companies out there. They contact me constantly about, hey, we'd like to be the one that does the enforcement for you. And did you know that you have 260 registered vacation rentals? I'm like, sweet. That's not right. That we have 200 that we found online, and if you do a search on your own, you might come up with a number and it says 600, but that's in the Morro Bay area. It includes Cayucas and Los Osos and the county and all of those things. And when you drill down to what's in the city, we have around that 250 number, and that's with us. We had some changeover in our business license folks, and so for a little while they haven't been actively, looking at ads, but they will be starting to do that again, and so that number that might be at 260 now will probably be dropping back down because we'll be catching those folks and moving on.
Yeah, so. I think that San Francisco, and I don't know who else, had settled with Airbnb, I think, to sort of have some notification back and forth if there were unlicensed vacation rentals that were advertising.
We're partnering with the county and a couple of the other jurisdictions to work with Airbnb on having them collect the money that they're supposed to be conveying to us, and make sure that that the folks that they're working with are licensed, and then they'll be collecting, you know, the TOT that's required, and then presenting it to the city. So those are some conversations that are ongoing right now that we're working through. So they've been willing to work with us, like, hey, give us a, you know, give us a path, you know, forward, and all, because they're a big company, all the better for them if we can get everybody kind of on the same page in the county anyway. So they're doing the same thing, so they're not doing one-offs with everybody. Mm-hmm. So they've been really willing to kind of sit down and talk to us because we've been willing to do that. So that's kind of part of what we're in the process of doing right now.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to hear. The other thing is, and this is with regard to the height limits, I'm not sure if it fits into this part of the discussion or not, but I noticed walking down Morro Bay Boulevard, there's a lot of sort of one-story places where behind them there's a lot of just empty nothing, okay? And it just seems like you maybe could combine, you know, discussion of height limits if you want to put housing in those areas or other things behind the retail. There's just a lot of empty land there, and maybe you could put something a little taller there that wouldn't have that canyon effect, but would still allow for fuller use of the land. I'm not sure even how that's all zoned. I couldn't quite tell in there, but it seems like that's sort of a mixed use thing, but that would still give you that character of the small one story, you know, shops, but still allow for people to use that for housing, and maybe even denser housing in the back. So. Anyway, I didn't know where that fit into this discussion, but it occurred to me.
I think largely the idea to go to the 37 foot was to encourage some mixed use development in the downtown, put some people out and living down there. Not dramatically change the way the downtown feels, because I don't know that we would want the whole thing going that tall. That would really change it.
If it was the back buildings that were a little taller, that would feel very different than if the buildings right on the street were, you know, you had the wall there. So anyway, that was maybe a thought about how maybe you could mix those things together, allow a little bit higher density and higher heights, but not impinge right on the sidewalk.
I think the approach that we're taking right now is a fairly measured one. It's a limited number of lots, and then doing the evaluation the Planning Commission requested and saying, hey, how many of these could actually happen? So how many buildings could we get, areas that could go that tall? And then looking at the time frame for our land use planning documents, over that time frame, how many would we expect to turn over? And, I mean, you're going to get a handful when we're done.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is allowing, it's not that, you know, they're either going to be that tall or they're not going to be that tall, but allowing the mixed heights on the same area, I think, would possibly be a good compromise for something like that. Yeah. And allow people to walk to shops and that kind of thing, still live there, but not be right on the street and still have the good small character of the shops.
I have a question.
There we go. I have a question. We're kind of walking randomly here. And I think we're going to want to do a lot more talking about the vacation rental. So, yeah.
Melanie, did you want to wait? Okay. Then, if we're all ready to move on, we have our consent calendar. We have meeting minutes from December 21st, 2017, and January 18th, 2018. Anybody have any comments, changes, adjustments? Do I have a motion to approve those minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you. And a second?
I'll second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None. All right. So we can move on to unfinished business, of which there's none, which takes us to new business. And it looks like we have our Michael Baker International presentation.
All right. Hi, everybody. Tonight we are, as you know, going to speak about zoning code module 3, and we have Lisa Wise Consulting here to lead us through that discussion. We are getting very close to releasing the public draft. I know you've been hearing that for a while. We expect that to happen in the next month, and you've been following the zoning code progress, and there is a fourth module that will come along pretty soon, and you will have a chance to review, and that will be the final module. And the draft environmental impact report is also being prepared, a little bit behind the plan itself. And I'm going to hand it off to Martha Miller to talk about zoning.
Thank you. So I just have a short presentation, just again, remind us why we're doing this exercise, give a summary of what's in Module 3 in the use regulations, but I want to save the time for the discussions and questions that you have and the discussion that we've already started. But basically reminding us why the city undertook this effort, and it's to update the zoning code to, in my mind, it's really two of the most important things. One, to be consistent with the general plan that you're currently updating, but then also to be easier to use and understand and to bring it into kind of today's world, consistent with current laws, current best practices for development and design of properties. So as Amy mentioned, we're making good progress. So we're in number 3 of 4 of the draft modules, or where they're really preliminary drafts of regulations that together will make your complete zoning code. So after this, we'll talk about citywide regulations. But then that's really, you've had a preliminary look at the complete zoning ordinance. So then we'll put that all together. We'll look at it again. All of what you've seen will be revised based on your comments, Planning Commission's comments, things from staff, from the public. We'll look at it all together, then we'll revise it again, and then it will go through the formal process of hearings and adoption. So this is the use regulation. So this packet, I'm going to start with talking about what's actually in the back of your packet, which is the use classifications, starting on page 71. And what that is really the definition of all the uses that we're regulating or allowing within the city. And one of the things that we heard when we started talking to people about your current zoning ordinance was that there isn't a complete set of uses and defined uses. So there was never quite sure exactly how people fit in, or, you know, what actually was a retail store, what went under that description. So there's comprehensive revisions to the definition of uses in your current code. So many existing uses have been redefined or renamed. New uses have been integrated and proposed. There's something such as urban agriculture that was not a consideration at the time that your code was drafted. We also consolidated long lists of use allowances, and that's so that we can have a more kind of easy to use and navigate tables of allowed uses. And then we broadened out use groups so that as new uses come forward, you can fit them under a description of a use type rather than having to try and imagine any type of use imaginable and having them list out. So the use classifications, it's a modern classification system that really groups uses and activities by common function, product, or characteristic. There's overall groups which are, you know, residential, whether they're public, commercial, industrial, transportation, communication utility, and then urban agriculture. And then within that, there's classifications, and then in some cases, there's the need to further break down some of those groups. So in retail sales, there's some kind of different types of retail sales that have some different treatments. So wherever there is needed to treat a different use differently, we break those out. So then going back, so that's the kind of the reference material. And then, so in your module, each zoning district will have use allowances by those districts. And they've been organized, or the use allowances are organized to implement and be consistent with your general plan and the local coastal land use plan, as well as state and federal law. There's some things that the law tells us we have to do. So there's been a lot of questions about, like, how does this compare to what's existing? Give us a one-to-one comparison of what's allowed today and what is proposed in here. And we tried to do that in a number of ways, but because your code is so complex and convoluted and not well defined, and if you ask people today if you can do something on your property, the answer is, well, maybe, let me see, look through, yes, and then maybe tomorrow it's no. There's a lot of interpretation to it. So we couldn't really execute that. I could not give you a list by district of what's allowed. That didn't have a lot of assumptions and interpretations in it. So what we tried to do in this packet to give some bit of a guide is just direct you back to what the current zoning district is, and you could look at that list of uses. So there's use allowances by district, and each of the sets of districts, we were introduced to them in Module 2, which had the development standards for the districts. In this module, we carried forward, even though you'd already seen it, we carried forward the purpose statements for the districts, because that's where we're really looking back to and then comparing the allowed uses. Do those allowed uses, and is the permit level appropriate given what that purpose of those districts are? The one difference is the waterfront and harbor area districts, and those you'll notice did not have the tables, and they really carried forward the existing language and kind of lists of permitted uses and conditionally permitted uses. And that's really why, because these are very unique districts and the use allowances for them. And it was, we couldn't get them to fit into this format without losing some important things that particularly we think Coastal would be cautious of. So that's my caveat for my organization. So the use allowances are presented in tables and indicated whether a use is permitted, if it requires a minor use permit, a conditional use permit, or if there's a dash in there, it's not allowed in that district. The other caveat that's carried into the tables is that, hey, even if you're permitted, a coastal development permit may still be necessary. So that was something that was confusing in your current ordinance, because that statement kind of wasn't out there, so it felt like a surprise sometimes. So we incorporated that note into the tables. Also included in the tables are cross-references to other applicable standards. So where a use has particular standards that apply to it, then there's the reference to that section. So the next section of your module is the standards for specific uses. So this is where, there are certain uses that no matter where they're located, they have standards specific to them because of their particular characteristics or potential for compatibility issues. So there's a number of uses that have specific standards, and we'll kind of summarize. Some of them are just carrying forward existing standards that are in your code now. The second set are ones that there's new standards. They're all new. They don't exist in your code today. And then the third group is kind of where you have existing standards, but there's proposed to be some revisions to them. So the ones carried forward are for employee housing and single room occupancy, and these are just limited to refinements to make it fit into the new structure. Then the set of standards that have revisions, and the revisions are summarized in the little notations in red at the start of each section to kind of give a guide. So for accessory dwelling units, you have standards for them. We've updated them consistent with state law. Animal keeping, carried those forward but included some things on beekeeping. Daycare, some new provisions for hours of operation, pickup, drop-off. Emergency shelters. This was more of a cleanup. There are some standards in there about providing appropriate things, and we tried to incorporate quantifiable and measurable standards for that implementation. Home occupations, bringing in the state law allowances for cottage foods. Non-permanent vendors, which revised and expanded your definition. So right now it's limited to balloons and flowers. So expanded that allowance to allow for some food and consumer products, and then operational and locational provisions. Outdoor dining and seating really had some clarifying provisions on hours of operation, noise, litter, parking, and then less than 350 square feet, you're allowed. If you want to do between 350 square feet and 1,000, there'd be a minor use permit required. Yep. Maybe save them to the end, because I'll go quick through. And then over 1,000 square feet, a conditional use permit. Outdoor display and sales have allowances, updated allowances for produce displays up to 125 square feet and live plant displays up to 600 square feet allowed. More than that would be a conditional use permit. With personal services, some new limitations on hours, locational limitations for Fortune, Palm, and card readers. And then temporary uses, clarifying. Fortune telling, Palm, and card readers are actually protected under free speech laws, rules for free speech. So that this is one of the protected use, as we call them. I could go on about that. Some interesting things to me. We'll talk later. temporary uses, there's new provisions for things that would be exempt from requiring a temporary use permit, such as garage sales and some fundraising sales. Then there's allowances for short-term events with a temporary use permit, and then anything that doesn't fit under those standards or those qualifications may be allowed, they just require a conditional use permit. So there's consideration for those. And then there's a set of uses that these are new standards. So your code doesn't have anything included in it now for these. So auto vehicle sales and services, so standards for those activities, washing service stations, drive-through facilities, standards on drive aisles, landscaping, walkways, requiring a circulation plan, personal storage, some standards requiring exterior wall treatments, more design related, recharging stations, specifically identifying that they are allowed in parking areas. That's come up as some confusion with the that this kind of being a new thing. Recycling facilities, locational screening design requirements for those various types of facilities. The short-term vacation rentals, you actually do have some standards for them, but in a way this was new in the zoning code. So Scott went over a number of the things proposed with that. Solar energy, establishing height and setback requirements for different energy systems. Telecommunication facilities, you do have existing standards for satellites, satellite dishes, but the actual telecommunication, the cell towers that you think about, those provisions are new. And then urban agriculture, so provisions for community market gardens, private gardens, urban agricultural stands have been incorporated. So that's kind of that broad general summary of all that, but I know you have a number of questions and we'll get into the details.
I wanted to just share a couple things from what Rich said. The first one is that his opinion is that if you moved all the terms and definitions up to the front of the code, that as readers go through, when they have their definitions right in front of them, rather than having to look for them in the back, that was one of his suggestions. Another one that both of us had a question about was churches or religious institutions. Do they fall under community assembly? Because there's often daycare associated, schools associated, recreational stuff, all of that. And in Morro Bay, they tend to be in our R1 districts. Okay. So that's where they'd fall, though?
Under yes.
Community assembly. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll let other people ask some questions, too, as we go through.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'll start. I had a couple of questions about the outdoor dining. And it seems like sometimes it's not so much the amount of outdoor dining, but the fact that sometimes it's on the sidewalk and in the way. So it's not really on the property necessarily of the establishment. It's actually, people have dogs and they're out in the side, and it's really easy to trip. And I'm just wondering is there some allowance or some way to deal with that kind of situation? It doesn't seem like outdoor dining that's off the street is one thing. Outdoor dining that's on the sidewalk is sort of another issue, I think.
You're not going to have outdoor dining opportunities that are on sidewalks addressed through the zoning code. They would be addressed through other sections of the municipal code because that's part of the right-of-way. These regulations relate to private property. So there's a difference there, and we do have policies that relate to what we can and cannot do there, but they wouldn't be dealt with through this mechanism because it's public property. This deals primarily with private.
Okay, all right.
But it's a good point, and it's one that we sort of...
It needs to go here somewhere.
It's something we internally struggle with and something that needs to be addressed. It's just not going to be part of this process.
Okay, so it seems like you can't have a garage sale in a public right-of-way. Well, why can you have a table, you know? I mean,
yeah.
So, okay, I just was wondering about that. Okay, I did have a question about the palm readers. Has that been a problem here? Is there any reason to treat them different from any other business?
I think we just didn't. I mean, do we have policies in there right now? We don't. We don't have any policies that speak to them at all now. Currently, I don't think.
You know, a lot of city policies actually do address fortune tellers, palm readers, card readers differently in terms of the fees that they charge for their permits. I know the Pismo code had a different. It was a classification by itself, and you had a certain fee for that. So I wondered that, too, why they were specifically isolated out and, you know, located 100 feet from any other such establishment.
Yeah, it seems like it's more of a, if somebody's, it's a consultation-type business, is there any reason to treat it different from any other, I mean, whether you believe in it or not, I mean, it's sort of a value judgment, which I'm not sure we should be making, but...
I mean, I guess to some extent, there's the question. I mean, we don't have
it. Worried about it's not. I mean, what
no, it's not addressed in our code, and you know, and I would imagine traditionally there's been a desire not to have an over concentration of those types of things. I mean, I could see us having them for other, you know, having a similar thing for other types of uses because we get sort of a concentration.
There are a lot of thrift stores around, for example, and nobody.
I was alluding to that as well. I mean, you could come up with something for a lot of.
You want diversity of commercial activity. That's certainly true in general. But I was wondering why it was sort of the focus on.
When I was in Pismo, we were looking at the same thing for tattoo shops. We started getting a whole bunch down on Pomeroy, and they were like lining up, and we were like, I don't think we want the tattoo shop district.
But it's not because they're tattoos. It's because people are lining up and maybe blocking the sidewalk. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Is I'm just not sure what kind of value judgment we should be making on the type of business. I mean, you know. So anyway, I guess I do question that. The garage sale issue, I did look through it, and it looks like you can, if you do garage sales, you can only do them twice a year. Is that...
That's the current requirement, yeah.
Okay, so if you do it during the citywide garage sale, you can't have garage sales like any other time in your... I don't never do garage sales, but I'm just wondering, that just seems very restrictive.
Yeah, you could have it one other weekend, and I'm not even honestly sure that... I would consider the community-wide garage sale an event, and so you might be able
so
to
that
have...
That doesn't count?
I would say, yeah. I mean, it's not so explicit in the code, but I don't know that I would count that. I think that's a community-wide event. That's a thing. Garage sales on their own, what it's... The limitation is meant to address that's somebody's business.
But yeah, you don't want to have a retail business in your driveway.
Yeah, next door to you, and every weekend, starting on Thursday through Sunday, they're selling all 4 days long.
I understand that, but it seemed somewhat restrictive. Yeah.
And I've run into issues with that in other places where we've had businesses like that through a code enforcement standpoint that we had to go and say, no, you're operating a business, you can't do that.
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable. And my question is twice a year. I don't know. I mean, like I said,
I don't... I've been here for 4 years. No one's ever complained about it.
Okay. All right, then.
I think that's a be nice to your neighbor thing. You know, so if you're going to have three, be sure you've informed your neighbors and people aren't parking in their their berms and all of that.
Okay, and I just have one more question. The personal storage issue, is that sheds? Or what is that exactly? I was trying to figure out what that... Is that people put surfboards on their house, on the side of their house? What is that exactly?
Oh, no, that's like self-storage facilities.
Oh, self-storage. Okay, because personal storage sounded more like an individual thing, and I wasn't really, it didn't really seem right when I was reading the rules. Okay, thank you very much for that clarification.
Okay, back to vacation rentals. Dive right back in. I'm not one that feels like we need to, I was generally okay with a lot of the things that were in the suggestions already, and I'm not one that thinks they need to be outlawed or should be outlawed. I feel like they attract a broad cross-section of people who want to visit, and I think that some measure of them is good. But I was questioning how typical it is for the designation, if you will, to run with the land, and so when ownership of a property changes, that that is allowed to continue with the new owner. That just seems odd to me for that kind of a use.
I've seen people that houses advertised as licensed vacation rental, and you see that all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. So maybe it's just the way it's done. It just strikes me that struck me as really odd.
I think I'd have to agree with that. Yeah. You're creating an economic value that passes with the property, and that makes it a different kind of business to me, mm-hmm. and it distorts the market.
And I just feel like it's really you want to vet people in some ways who are doing it, and you want them to agree to the rules, and I don't think that automatically transfers to a new owner necessarily.
Also, I think if there are people on a waiting list, especially if you've got that kind mm-hmm. of thing, mm-hmm. it's
yeah.
fair to kind of spread it around a little bit.
If
someone's in their house and they want to take advantage of that, that's fine. But if you're once they sell, then it maybe the next it would be fair for the next person in line to get the chance at it.
I mean, it's a land use thing. Land use permits and those types of things typically run with the land. And so sometimes it's a selling point for folks as well when things come forward.
I would rather see it removed, though, because, you know, we're talking about areas that already have permitted uses as residences. That's the primary use. So if somebody sells that and it can revert to a primary residence, and then so maybe somebody next door or who's on the waiting list can then have an opportunity.
So we could alter it. I mean, how about this? I mean, we could alter it that if – It kind of depends on where we end up going with the existing ones, right? Mm-hmm. When we put the moratorium in place and the cap at 250, we said, hey, that's great, but guess what? When we're done and we get our ordinance, it's a new day, and this ordinance will tell you whether you're grandfathered or not when we're done. It would be a heck of a lot of work if we don't do it that way because there's going to be a lottery process, and I don't look forward to that. But we may end up going down that road, and it may literally start day one, and we do them from that point forward, and that's just how it is, and you're either lucky or you're not. It's just a lot of work to do that.
Well, no, I think if you're talking about as the houses turn over, you're not talking about all of a sudden everything expires and you have to start over.
Yeah, I'm going down. I'm mm-hmm. getting there.
Okay,
I was just saying, so the idea here would be we could change it to reflect that if it comes up, and you want to transfer it, you come in, and if that one is within 200 feet of another one, then no, it's non-conforming, and you don't get to continue it.
At a minimum, that would seem appropriate.
For sure,
but
that
I think,
seems appropriate.
We could do that. I mean,
but we're raising a different issue in addition to that, I think, which is if mm-hmm. you're running into the problems with the cap, that you allow somebody else.
We won't have a cap. We're not going to have a cap.
And
Coastal won't let us put a cap in. So that conversation's sort of – I mean, we could try, but they'll just deny it. I've been told that several times. So
you can't have a cap on the number of vacation rentals in a community?
Well, we're doing it through buffers. I'm actually having a map put together right now that's going to show what it looks like with all of our current ones. At 200 feet, it's going to blow out the entire city is my guess, with 250.
Okay.
Yeah.
250 will be the max anyway, you're saying?
I'm saying right now with the 250 that we have and looking at the dispersion, my guess is it's pretty much when the mapping gets done, which will be tomorrow or beginning of next week, it's going to show the entire city encumbered.
So let me ask then, if we wanted to somehow limit the density, and we've got one way to do that then would be to increase the distance between them, because then you would end up pushing them into districts where they don't typically exist. So right now they are concentrated to a pretty high degree. I have one on both sides of me. I have one across the street. I've got one about maybe 300 feet down the road, mm-hmm. a big one. And there's another one on the other end of the other block. We're surrounded by them.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to create less density of those things, one mechanism would be to increase the distance between them. And that would then force some dispersion. A related question. I looked at the ordinance today, and it did not say anything about being temporary or interim. And when I first started hearing about this issue, that's what people said to me. We've got a temporary ordinance on the books. So I was wrong about that, because it's not in the current ordinance.
We have a moratorium in place right now, which
right.
is temporary and will
right.
expire coming up here in June.
And if those some of those licenses are out of compliance at that point, is there a mechanism other than the lottery? I mean, is the lottery going to be a legal process? Are we going to have a problem with that?
So, I mean, my take on this and preference is not to do it that way, because it would be a very laborious process. Because we'd have to take them as they came in, stamp them. These came in a row, map that one. Next one came in, map that. I mean, we'd have to map them one by one by one by one. And then every time you came into conflict, you'd be like, nope. Next one, I mean, it would take quite a while. But that might be where we end up. I don't know. Preference would be to have them go, you know, keep the ones that we have and then have them go away over time. But there's issues like you describe where you live, and there's that issue is in other neighborhoods as well. Beach Track being one of them. I know there's a couple of different streets over there where they're, you know, the streets have like 10 houses on them, and several of them have like 4 vacation rentals on them. Right. And so I understand having that concentration around you. I understand not liking it. Like you're describing, and the same for those folks that have brought that to my attention. So it might not be possible. It might just be where we go, but that's not the way that it's set up right now. So that I mean that's good information to get from you though. If that's the desire from the committee, you should put that forward so we can bring that forward to Planning Commission.
I wonder if you sort of consistent with the point that Melanie raised, if you not only said as they expire or as the house sells, if you look and see if they're not in compliance, maybe that goes away at that time. But also if you do have a waiting list for people who want the vacation homes in that area but they weren't able to because it would make them non-compliant or something, that again, you maybe give other people a chance instead of having it be a sort of a permanent part of the property, that you give other people a chance to have that benefit as well. And then if nobody's in the way, if there's nobody sort of in line and you're in compliance, well, then you can just renew. But, you know, that's a suggestion.
If you went with the 200-foot thing, approximately how many vacation rentals is that per block, say? I mean, is that two in the average?
It depends on what area of town you live in.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm having them. I'm sorry I didn't have it done for this meeting. I've got a lot of things going on.
Okay.
But I am having it done so we can take a look at it and see what it looks like. But my guess, and when I was kind of looking at the map and where some of them were, and when I started just kind of looking I looked at North Morro Bay, and I was like, okay, and I plugged in about 10 vacation rentals looking at where they would go, and I was like, okay, it took out like the whole northern portion on the east side of the highway. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. And so what I realized when we started putting the 250 in, unless there's a super concentration in one area, but when I look through them, they're largely dispersed all over town. We have some concentrations like you talked about in certain areas, but they're largely dispersed all over town. I would imagine when we're done mapping it, there's not going to be a whole lot of area left. So I'm thinking the 200-foot buffer has kind of done the same thing as the 250 cap. Mm-hmm. It can move, though. I mean, you know, with things moving around, you could, you know, with more even dispersion, you could get a few more, and it just depends. But I would imagine what I'm going to get back is something that shows most of the areas in town are not eligible. Most of the areas in red, because those are residential zones. This is, you know, we're going to have, that'll be the limitation of residential zones. We won't have, you know, we won't need similar limitations in commercial because it's a commercial, mostly a commercial.
Do you think this is a... I'm trying to rack my brains. Do you think this is a city attorney question then? I mean, in terms of this sort of entitlement, if you will, running with the land or this...
It doesn't have to.
It doesn't have to.
Your desire, you know, majority of your desire is not to have that, then we can remove that and say that's what the GPAC said. They'd rather not have it and run with the land. I mean, it's not required
by any law.
Okay, yeah. I couldn't remember. Yeah, because some things we couldn't change.
I wonder if that's something we could just quickly pose that question. And, you know, again, this is a body that makes recommendations, not policy. So I think it's really fair if it sounds like most of us are feeling the same way.
And it was in Rich's comments, too.
And it was in Rich's comments as well. So I would recommend that we not have that designation go with the property when it sells.
So I see several of you saying yes, Jan, Joe?
Yes, I would agree.
Okay.
I would agree. I don't know what the rationale would be to let the new owner inherit this instead of when maybe somebody else in the town would like to have it. I would agree that it should not go with the property.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pleased to hear that on some of these really important issues we're developing some kind of a consensus mechanism, because me being new to the panel, I was wondering how we were going to sort out what our individual comments and what we as a group really want to get passed along. So that's one thing. Two, if there are a significant number of these vacation rentals, non-compliant vacation rentals in an area, then it seems reason enough not to have it run with the land so that you can address that in a shorter term. So I would be very much in favor. The 200-foot limitation strikes me as it might be a good distance, but it's probably fairly arbitrary. I mean, why not 250? Why not 300? Why not 150? So what's the reasoning behind 200?
My concern here is that, you know, in going through this process, is that we're looking to ordinances that the Coastal Commission has been willing to adopt. Because we can come up with all kinds of things that we want in here. City of Pismo Beach is doing that. City of Santa Cruz came up with all kinds of things that they wanted in there, and the Coastal Commission came down on them and said, absolutely not. So I was like, I don't want to have, if I can avoid it, have those types of things in it that hang the certification process up. So what we did is we took a look at the county's ordinance that they have adopted in the coastal zone, and they have buffers of 100 feet in some areas and 200 feet. 200 feet was the most restrictive that they have. I was like, They certified it, I'm going to start at 200. And then if there's a desire to go dramatically bigger than that, I want to look and see what the impacts of that those are, so I can bring that and have that analysis done, which is why I'm having them mapped right now. And again, I apologize for not having it ready for this meeting. Just wasn't in the cards with everything else that was going on. But certainly when I get to the Planning Commission, they'll have that information to be able to. So you can voice your concerns about it. The Planning Commission can take a look at it, and we'll be able to go, okay, and have a little bit more information. Again, apologize for it not being here.
Now, see, that's a good response, because I for one, see the value of these kind of safe harbors, particularly when you're dealing with the Coastal Commission.
Yeah, I mean, I want to remove as many barriers to us getting our final document certified as I can. And then if there's a desire to have, you know, greater restrictions, ones that maybe they're not comfortable with, maybe they're, you know, willing to do some horse trading, and I can do that offline with them and say, what if we do this and not that, and that, you know, that type of thing, and see where they go. And then I can bring that information back so the decision makers have, you know, full knowledge.
So another principle in this area that seems kind of important to me is accountability for the unit. And in the current ordinance, it says the owner's agent can file the license. And I'd prefer to see that say the owner has to file that license. And it, in some way, tie that person to that business so that we know who's accountable for it. And in some cases, the local agent may be working with people who aren't even really here very much, don't really know our circumstances, and may not get a full appreciation for what our objectives are in our laws and our ordinances.
So you're talking about the section that's actually in, not in what's before you, but in Title 5.47.
5.47, but I think we want to carry that forward into this new ordinance, and maybe if there's some way to strengthen it so that, well, owner occupancy is probably not on the cards here, from what I'm hearing about Coastal.
It was pretty clear that wasn't going to get through. Yeah.
Like no owner occupancy rules, or maybe just allowing some more liberal rules if their owner is on site, or is there no sort of way to get that?
I haven't spoken with Coastal staff. The Santa Cruz item went before the commission at their last meeting, so it's fresh. And so I don't know what the internal conversation is on it. I just read the staff report and went, oof, this is, you know, they were trying to lock some things down, and it didn't seem to go very well.
I was just going to say, treating the two different sometimes makes enforcement harder, because then you have that question, well, is it owner-occupied or not? And having either a yes or no sometimes is just easier for enforcement's sake, for everybody treated the same.
Yeah. It's
kind
of hard to have a conversation
really
get half of the.
So aren't Airbnbs different, though, than vacation rentals? I mean, I thought the whole concept of Airbnb was you're in your home and you're going to rent out a room to somebody who's on tour now. Okay. All right.
Well, this is starting to raise an issue I was wondering about. I just, maybe because I don't understand all the definitions, but is it possible under our current or prospective rules for somebody to get a vacation rental license for a room in their house? Because that's a typical Airbnb
so
model.
So the definition of the short-term rental, and this is your current mm-hmm. definition, which would be carried forward, is the rental of any structure or any portion of any structure for occupancy for dwelling, lodging, or sleeping purposes for 30 consecutive calendar days or less.
In other words, the answer is yes. You can get one of those. So then the extended question I have is, in some ways it seems to me that businesses like that are preferable in a way, because if the owner is living there and renting a room, it helps them cope with really high housing prices. So there's an advantage to that. And we might even want to encourage it to a greater extent, maybe with smaller buffers between them, so that there's a way to maintain the owner's responsibility on the site, provide visitor-serving accommodations that are probably more affordable, coastal like that, and we can collect more TOT. So
just by kind of way of reference, the city of San Luis Obispo does something that they allow homestays, so you have to be in your house and you can rent out a portion of it, but you can't be on vacation. Like the owner physically has to be there. Mm-hmm. They actually don't allow, if I'm remembering correctly, they don't allow, that's the only type of short-term rental that they allow in residential.
In residential zone.
And they call it a homestay.
They call it a
homestay. So that's a distinct category here, different than vacation rental.
Yeah, the way they define that. Yeah.
Do we want to consider doing that?
You got to look that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it strikes me, I mean, they're two very different beasts.
Yeah.
I mean, renting an entire home on a short-term basis and renting a bedroom. They shouldn't be combined or conflated, I think.
But they are in the Airbnb business model, right?
Right.
I mean,
right,
in the
right,
business
right.
model that's so commonly understood today, yeah. They are conflated.
I know, but I'm suggesting for purposes of our ordinances, we should make a distinction. Hmm.
It seems like, you know, helping, say, a low-income person to stay in a home or an older person to stay in a home, that would be that sort of a worthy goal as opposed to having somebody with an investment,
yeah.
Which is not, there's nothing wrong with having an investment, but it is more depersonalized and it is the person that is not really a member of the community, at least as far as where they live. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some basis, at least in it for some difference.
I see several of you sort of nodding your heads in agreement with that. So then would we want buffers for those between them, or are we just okay with that type of use with occupancy limitations? I mean,
again, I'm hearing the voices of the constituency. I mean, and there are going to be a significant number of people who, you know, on a block with 10 houses are not going to want to see five or six of those houses, you know, renting out rooms. So I mean, either we have to, you know, take the opinion of the community, or we have to come up with something that's regarded as, you know, acceptable and reasonable.
I have a lot less concern if the owner's on site, to be honest. And then, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you know, you have to still have complaint processes and all kinds of things like that. But I just have a lot less concern if someone's renting out, you know, a bedroom in their house, but they're there all the time and they're there to address problems and they are a member of the community versus somebody who, you know, doesn't live here, doesn't, you know, it's really just an investment for them.
I mean, that I would like to say I agree with that. Our next door neighbor in Morro Bay for several years was an owner who was extremely troubled and rented to a lot of other extremely troubled people. So it didn't have that effect at all. You know, it was not. It didn't allow any of them to live an upstanding life in that house. So yeah, I mean, it can go a lot of different directions. You know, I totally
yeah.
agree with it from the how it was originally described in the homestay idea. I totally agree with it. Just it really doesn't always work out quite like that.
We can't avoid all problems.
No,
so
no.
I think we still need to have buffers and parking regulations.
I think so.
And you know, the density issue is still there, and I just think that the impact of this would be less because it's likely to be just one room, probably just one car, probably just two people. It's one room, so I think we need to have some.
100 foot?
Some regulations on it?
It seems like the same rule should apply as if somebody's living there full time. You have to have parking. Mm-hmm. You have to have, I mean, there's certain parking things that apply to single family homes, and they should apply also to single family homes that are rented, where one of the bedrooms is rented short-term basis.
Are we comfortable with it? It seems like you want to have a lesser buffer because you think it's a better version of this. Do you want to reduce the buffer by something, or do you want to leave it at 200? If you're leaving it at 200, then there's no reason to call them out. It's addressed in our code, or in the draft code.
I think we leave it.
Leave it at 200. But I have another thing that got real confusing when you're reading about short-term rentals and renting a room, and then it came the classification of accessory dwelling. If you have does that mean like a mother-in-law unit like
correct.
I have? But it says that they can't in here. That one cannot be rented when the other is not occupied by the owner. So how is an accessory unit different from renting your place, a short-term rental on your house?
Right. We'd be setting up a different standard because we're saying you can't.
We're not allowing them in accessory dwelling units because accessory dwelling units, the intent behind those is those are going to be affordable housing type units by design. And so if that's the intent behind it, that's the intent by the legislature, by the way, as well, then we probably shouldn't be using them for vacation rentals. We probably should be using them for housing. Now, if you want to, but we don't have the distinction in here where the primary dwelling could be used as a vacation rental, but the one that's supposed to be affordable, we placed a limitation on. The one that's supposed to be affordable, the one that's supposed to provide that additional housing is the accessory dwelling unit. We said no.
But then why? Okay, if you had a property with an accessory dwelling, then according to this, the owner cannot rent both units. And the owner has to be living in one of them. The owner cannot rent both of them out.
That's what that says.
Separately.
Right.
That's current code.
Yes.
That's what the code says, yeah.
It just seemed like it was getting confusing about short-term rentals and renting a room in your house and things like that.
And the other thing, accessory dwelling units are intended to be rental housing, rented for periods of longer than 30 days, and short-term rentals are defined as 30 days or less. So two different things. It's just the question of could that accessory dwelling unit that's supposed to be someone's apartment be used as a short-term rental?
And the answer is no.
The answer at this point is no, right?
That's what Scott was just talking about.
And at this point, they cannot both be long-term rentals either, because one of them has to be occupied by the owner.
Correct, because if they were two long-term rentals, then basically you've created duplex use on a single-family zone. The idea is state legislature says we need more affordable housing. It benefits the homeowner. He rents his accessory or her unit to someone, and then the person renting the unit has a source of affordable housing as well.
So you're also looking at two different sections of the code?
Yeah.
Whereas you're looking at the actual accessory dwelling unit ordinance, where the occupancy limitation that you reference comes from, and then we have the other portion of it that is in the vacation rental section that says you can't use that accessory dwelling unit for that. So it comes from two different sections of the code.
Is there any enforcement of the requirement that the owner live in one of the unit that is not the accessory dwelling unit? Does anybody?
Well, when it would come up is when we got that would be complaint driven, and it would be pretty easy to find out.
Okay, so there's no check of property tax records I wouldn't even know that, but I guess postal records. I don't know what you would look at to do that, but. So it's more like it's more.
I mean, you can verify it through tax records. You can verify through several things, like where they're paying their taxes at and that type of thing.
So I live in a house that I rent that I guess would be considered the main house on the property because it's the larger one. There's an accessory unit behind me. It's all one property, one owner, and both of us are renters. So are we out of compliance? I mean, I think the owner actually he bought up a ton of properties in town at one point, you know, several decades ago.
I think for that you'd have to look into the actual, case that it is and when it was built and whether it's an accessory dwelling unit as the term, you know, the defined term accessory dwelling unit, or is it a second unit on the property that you just happen to have in your mind that you call it an accessory dwelling unit?
Just because it's smaller.
Yeah.
You know.
It could be a duplex situation.
Yeah. There's no shared walls.
Yeah.
It's two freestanding units, but one's bigger than the other one.
Yeah, I mean, it only starts coming into play if you're in like an R1 zone and you have a single family limitation, and then how you have another unit legally would be through an accessory dwelling unit process, or if something that's non-conforming that was built a while ago and was built as two separate units that was never part of any of the secondary unit ordinances, accessory dwelling unit ordinances, those types of things.
No, it's
that have been
a couple of old beach shacks is what
Yeah, so it might just simply be a non-conforming thing. I mean, we like to keep those.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
I would like you to keep them.
Yeah.
Okay. Scott's comment, though, just raised something else for me that you were talking about referencing two separate parts of the code.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something just to make a general comment. I think you just referenced something, too. That is a confusing piece of this. It's difficult to reference back and forth. And now that I'm thinking about it, there's a lot of references to TBD. And TBD is the page number. Is that right? So the page numbers aren't there. So if the page numbers were there, I could have just flipped to the page number. Is that what the TBD
is? It's not going to be page numbers because not everybody's going to be looking at this as a hard copy or the same document.
Yeah.
It's going to be section numbers and the names of those sections.
Uh-huh.
And then that way, in the electronic version, there can be hyperlinks to it. You can always navigate.
Yeah.
The reason there's the TBD is because as we're doing this in sections, numbers change, things get added. It's just for this preliminary stage. So when we do the complete draft, all those TBDs will be filled out.
But I think that's what I was reminding myself.
Right.
Because I feel like that's going to make it easier to navigate. And
absolutely.
At the time, I just sort of wrote off the TBDs, and I was like, oh, those don't exist yet. I'm not going to go look for them.
Right.
But then I got to them at the end of the document,
right.
And I went, oh, you know.
Because some of them are in here. Some of them actually were in other things you looked at. Some of them are things that you will look at.
Right.
I do want to actually, this brings up that whole question of the audience and how is this confusing and how to use it. The thing to keep in mind is that no one will take the zoning code and read it as you are doing right now. That is not how this gets used. They go, you know what? I want an accessory dwelling unit. I am going to look at that section, or I am in the RS district. I am going to look at that section. So we really look at it section by section or piece by piece, and that's why we have the cross-references, and you'll notice in the occupancy limitation for accessory dwelling units, because that question of short-term rentals comes up a lot, they wanted to make it clear, so it says accessory dwelling units shall not be used as short-term rentals in the ADU, and then also in the short-term rental section, it will say accessory dwelling units cannot. So it won't be used how you're using it today.
Right.
As far as the audience, there's many different audiences that will be using this. So it is staff. It's, like I said, unlikely someone is just going to read it. It's homeowners, business owners, either people here or interested in something here. It's also a legal document, and it's also a technical document, which is why oftentimes it may seem dry or a little generic or boring. But well, yeah, for us, it's something. But one thing that is helpful for those types of things of, you know, I'm in the RS district, what can I do, is handouts that the department can put together for things that they consistently get questions on or people want to know that story about. So so while we try and make this as engaging and as user-friendly and as possible, we are cognizant that it is a legal document and it is a technical document. So.
Can I loop back? The discussion got away from me before I had a chance to think about it, but I do want a smaller buffer for the Airbnb single room, maybe 150, and that would be from any other kind of business. So there'd be 150 feet from a regular house that's a vacation rental. Couldn't happen. That would have to be 200 because the vacation rental house would demand a 200-foot barrier. So that means that if you can get enough of the single room in my house to start filling in, you're pushing out the density. So I would like to see a different buffer for it.
May I? I don't disagree with the issue in terms of providing housing, certainly for people who are in need.
Mm-hmm.
Or even the occasional vacationer. But I suspect that the people in the neighborhoods will object when they see too many outside individuals renting rooms in their neighborhood, on their block, on a continual basis. So it's one of those things where, while we're trying to serve a good purpose, there are going to be some unintended consequences.
There would be, but you're going to have an owner there, which makes it fundamentally different. And you're probably going to have, you're not going to have a place like the one down on Lucita near me that has seven cars parked there, because it's a really big place. It's not going to happen that way if you've got a single room in somebody's house.
Well, no, I don't believe the objection. I agree that the sort of noise and behavior violations, I think certainly an owner on property can take care of that. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm arguing from a civic standpoint. Just the notion of a stable neighborhood changes when there are lots of 24-hour visitors to a neighborhood.
I understand. I think I'm trying to argue that the smaller units would have less impact overall, and be more benefit for us and for the homeowners if we encourage that. I'm trying to encourage that as opposed to whole houses being taken over for vacation rentals.
But when you say encourage that, what do you mean that? Do you mean short? Are you talking about short term or are you talking about long term?
I'm talking about homestays.
Which are?
That would be the Airbnb model where you rent a room in my house.
Short term.
Yeah, short term.
So we're talking about having two different pieces of code. We're talking about having a short term vacation rental and a short term homestay or short term single room vacation rental?
That's the words I'm hearing tonight, yes.
Yeah, I think that anybody can rent a room in their house. I mean, people are entitled to rent rooms in their house in general. And so the fact that they're renting them for smaller, you know, shorter stays, as long as they're still there, I guess I'd be comfortable with that, too.
And we collect TOT.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was going to offer something similar. So, yes, anybody can rent a room more than, it has to be more than 30 days. But so in your situation, that was probably what was happening long-term, right. I think something to keep in mind is that the notion of the homestay or somebody renting out a single room in an owner-occupied house is much less desirable than renting an entire house. And so I don't think you're going to have every house on the block with one room rented out. I know I use Airbnb quite a bit when I travel, and that's never anything I'm interested in. And I don't know in San Luis Obispo what the... I don't believe they have separation requirements, and I don't know what the concentration is. But I would not anticipate it to be something where how you have now with whole vacation houses taking over blocks. I don't know that allowing just one room, everybody. I don't know how many people would actually do that.
But I think Glenn was saying that he thought he would prefer that count towards the concentration. Did I understand that correctly? That the homestays would count.
Yes, it would count toward the
so
concentration.
So you wouldn't be able to have as many of the standalone or whole house.
Yeah, because they're going to still have to be 200 feet away from that single room.
So is the 200 feet from front door to front door?
I don't know how they measure it.
Or from property line
it's from
to property, property line.
It's from property line.
Property line, okay.
Given the width of people's lots, that would make a big difference, actually. Mm.
Do you think that we have most of the lots in town are 50 foot wide on average? Some of them are quite a bit narrower than that. You can see at 200 feet get you quite a distance of separation between them.
Yeah. I would.
So
point.
we have an area
yeah,
of
kind
lack
of, an
of clarity.
Here.
I know.
Yeah,
I know,
it seems
so.
Like if. I wonder how often and if that happens that a person rents out a room in their house, do they bother with permitting and licensing it? Or do they just, I mean, is everything on Airbnb that, it's more of a European model to go stay in the house with the person and experience that life and eat that food, and I guess we don't do that as much here. But do we have that?
Yes, we do have some on Airbnb
okay.
now.
And they're the Airbnb with the owner occupying the house.
Well, it's a room in a house, so I assume
okay.
that the owner is there.
Yeah, we have one. We have those that are registered as vacation rentals.
It's usually a single person or a couple, mm-hmm. I think.
Sure.
And it's a lot less expensive usually than renting a whole house.
I think we just include that in the numbers, and you know, maybe it's a thing in terms of the goal of having affordable housing and keeping people in their homes. Maybe somehow get the word out that that's available to them, that that's a possibility. Some people may not realize that. I don't know. A lot of people wouldn't care for it.
So I mean, before we started the conversation, I sort of got the idea that, hey, if we could not allow them residential zones, that'd be where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're having the conversation about reducing the buffer for things that we're trying to encourage.
Yeah. Like we can't not allow them in residential zones because we're in the coastal zone.
Yeah, the Coastal Commission seems to come down the side that they're – you can get real specific. I mean, you can start going, hey, they're allowed in this neighborhood and not this neighborhood, and then they look at the buffering and how much distance you're putting between them because they don't want it to be overly restrictive mm-hmm. because it's an affordable means for families to come to the coast.
Sure.
You'll hear that repeated many, many times. So it sort of depends. I mean, you can go – neighborhood by neighborhood and change the requirement for each one. Some cities have done that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very complicated, mm-hmm. and laborious to
I mean, I look at areas like along Pacific where you've got a lot of apartments and townhouse, condominium-type structures. I'm assuming a lot of those are vacation rentals. No. Yes.
Some
maybe.
Are.
I've seen signs out with so.
There are some. I don't know that it's mm-hmm. more of a concentration in those than okay. there are in standalone single families. Mm-hmm. I mean, we probably have more standalone single families actually.
Because in my mind, that would be the area you would want to promote them because it's walking distance to downtown. It's walking distance to the waterfront. It's kind of a nice, and it's a little more. It's a denser area.
That opens a whole new can of worms, doesn't it?
I know.
How do we deal with apartments?
Well, I guess one of the questions is the whole 200-foot question. If you've got lots in the Heights that are large and lots in North Morrow that are small, you're going to have a lot more that are allowed in the areas with the smaller lots. And is that really what you should be encouraging? Or should you be encouraging less of them in areas that are smaller lots? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I assume the conversation must have happened before, but and if you have apartments, for example, within 200 feet, you could have, you know, way more people involved somehow. You know, I don't know. I guess I'm questioning that 200.
Well, obviously, the closer the housing, the greater the impact from the individual vacation rental unit that it could be, right? You know, you have it in a neighborhood of standalone single families, even if it's in North Morro Bay on 2,400 square foot lots. You know, your separation between you're a house away. You probably don't care other than maybe they're taking up parking on the street. You're in a condo complex, then you have to deal with it, and you're surrounded on two sides and above and below,
yeah, okay.
and that could be
mm-hmm.
impacts to all of that if they're not behaving. So. Again, was really taking the premise that, from what I've heard, that we didn't really want these in residential zones, so we kind of came up, we need to come up with policies to regulate them appropriately and not over-regulate them so we can get it through a process with the Coastal Commission. And it seems like the conversation is now swinging a little back and forth about, well, we should encourage them here or not there. I was like, are you really wanting to encourage them, or were you really thinking that you didn't want them in residential zones but we're sort of being forced to deal with them, so how's best to do that? I don't
Just
an observation on my part sitting here.
I think maybe, again, we need to my personal preference would be to do whatever needs to be done to have as few as possible, because I think we've stated in our goals and our objectives that we want to provide affordable housing for the people who live here, and we have a problem with that, and we don't have enough housing. I mean, I even wondered, do we want to introduce the concept of rent control? As a renter, I'll tell you, you know, and I've talked to a bunch of people, all of a sudden everybody's rents are going up, whether that's related to the anticipation of the water sewer thing, but I just got a notice, and it's a significant increase. There's a push, even in my neighborhood, a couple gals are leaving the neighborhood. They're moving out because the rent went up so high, and the response from the property manager was, well, you know, I can charge it, market rate. The realtors sit down and talk about that. What are you charging? What are you, you know? So you know, we're going to lose, and as those turn over, you know, are they going to become more vacation rentals and not places for people to live? So I guess my feeling would be whatever we can do to keep that at a minimum, because our hotels are not full. You know, if we're concerned about places for people to stay, our hotels are not full. And some of them do offer $69 a night rooms, especially in the off season. You know, so I mean, all right, well, yeah, but some do. They do. They're, you know, so
Sunday to Thursday.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's a time I get a lot of visitors during those times. So, you know, I guess I don't know.
So, could I offer just to help try and move us forward on this? Staff is putting together a map showing that 200-foot buffer and what that would look like, and I think that can help you answer the buffer question and how much does that really mean or what would that result in. So maybe, you know, hold off on making a decision on the buffer for now. And then the question of the homestay, because right now if somebody did rent out just a room in their house, that is a vacation rental that would be subject to the buffer thing. So if somebody did just rent out a room, that counts towards, you know, that is a vacation rental. So what you were talking about, I think maybe think on that homestay question a little bit, because it seems to be a new kind of concept and people are just thinking about it now, but maybe hold on making any decisions on that unless you have some clear direction now.
Works for me. Anybody else? Can I ask a quick question on page 30? It is under waterfront and harbor area districts, conditionally permitted uses, which is number 3, section E, power plant cooling water intake facilities. Are we still doing that?
We don't know what we're going to be using it for. We'd like to be able to maintain that for other potential uses.
I just wondered if it was like a placeholder just in case.
Just keeping our – there's been interest for various things and maybe, you know, more renewable energy type things that might be able to make use of those types of things. It could be interesting. So if you make it nonconforming, then you can't use it, right? So let's not do that. That's kind of the idea.
Another question on page 44 about emergency shelters. And I know we generally think of that as folks who are without housing on a transient kind of basis, but what about for emergencies? Is that, you know, so there's a fire, there's a landslide, there's a flood. I assume the city has some ordinances for where we have shelter for people, whether it's the high school gym or what, but is that included in this as well when we're talking about, or is this... Did the emergency shelters specifically refer to, say, a homeless person who needs housing when it's raining? Or
I think that's largely the way the ordinance here is directed. We have emergency response plans, you know, in place that the fire department maintains, emergency operations center requirements, and those types of things that say where we shelter, and depending on what the emergency is, that type of thing, whether it's a community center. So an example, we had the rains recently, right? It rained a lot. We had a ton of rain in town in a short amount of time, 4 inches. Creek flooded, went over the banks. We had to evacuate Silver City Mobile Home Park and the one west of that as well. It didn't stay at peak very long, but the shelter location was the community center. We actually set up the EOC that day, and so yeah, so that's it's under a separate planning effort that we have that runs through our fire department.
Yeah, it seemed like there was on the length of stay, it talked about the maximum stay, but then it specifically refers to a homeless person, and so I was wondering if it would. Well, I guess that homeless person is not necessarily what you think of as sort of a chronically homeless person. It could be someone who's lost their home for some.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. But it would. I mean, then shouldn't you just say the maximum length of stay is this amount? I mean, why would somebody be there anyway if they weren't? But a maximum length
staff.
Of stay. Oh, okay. I guess the staff is going to live there.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
I.
Okay.
Yeah, we
Yeah, it's state law. We didn't have this ordinance before, and so we were non-compliant with state law. We just followed state law at the time.
Okay.
But we incorporated it in the ordinance, and as Cindy said, it was in 2014. So it just comes out of the minimum requirements for this out of state law. That's what it comes from.
Okay. Is it, if it's a domestic violence situation, for example, is that I guess that's a homeless person also? I missed. Okay.
And we're not talking about just temporary uses that are set up in a community center with this.
I was just pointing out that we have a different process that we do for this.
That's what I'm saying. I was keeping that totally separate in my head. This is for operators who would come in and operate emergency shelters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Scott, I have a question. On page 30, section 2B, where it talks about existing units, uses rather might be expanded. I had difficulty trying to understand that provision. Does that mean one of those restaurants in the Measure D area could be expanded if there wasn't a parking problem? Page 30, 2B.
It does say they cannot be expanded, though.
As long as there is no parking demand unmet. That's a kind of a difficult sentence with two negatives.
Well, the no parking demands unmet, it's in relation to that you can be redeveloped on this in the same use.
But not expanded, regardless.
But not expanded, regardless, right. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't understand that. What, as long as there is no parking demand unmet. No parking unmet.
Well, if there is parking demand unmet, you can do nothing, right? If there's
a parking problem, you can do nothing.
You can do nothing. But
right.
if there's not a parking problem, you can redevelop.
Does no parking demands unmet on the site mean that people come there and they can park on the site, but if they have to park anywhere else, then it is a demand unmet on the site?
Not necessarily. it could deal. We have recognized parking credits down on the waterfront, and that's a whole other discussion. But it just could mean historically that was the use that was there, and we've not changed it, or we've not changed it to a more intense use, and so it remains there. And it's parking situations is the same as it's always been, type thing. So it doesn't really get to that level. And this is language that's brought forward from our current ordinance.
So could you just say, as long as parking demands are met, and eliminate all the double negatives? And
well, my question is, I'm wondering why are we encouraging certain uses grandfathered but inappropriate uses in Measure D, such as restaurants, to be expanded or enlarged?
But we're not. That's the thing.
It doesn't do that.
You can't expand or enlarge.
Yeah.
Unless.
So why doesn't the period go after expanded?
You can redevelop, you can't expand, right? But I mean, it obviously isn't saying that clearly enough. But
yeah, it can be rewritten for clarity, but really what this was the existing language carried forward, but we can revise it to clarify that intent, and which is that existing uses may be remained and may be redeveloped in the same use as long as parking demands are met. But there's no expansion or
clearly there needs to be a comma in there. Yeah.
Sort of like same use and footprint, you know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like rewriting the Second Amendment.
On that same section, we talk about that we want those grandfathered uses, you know, we want to. Those aren't what we are encouraging, right? The grandfathered uses. I'm not sure it's clear what we do want to encourage there. I mean, we talk about fishing. I guess it's not so clear to me how this gets enforced now, because we want to have uses that are supportive of or related to commercial fishing, right? We don't want to have these other commercial uses. That's, I think, generally, right, the intent?
In the Measure D area, it does say that, but then it also, you know, has that caveat in there that refers to the existing nonconforming and says they don't have to go away.
And I was just trying to, because I know that recently there was that attempt to take over, I'm not going to get any names right, but I think it was South Bay Wild trying to take over the Quonset Hut type space mm-hmm. for for sales, right, of their product, which I thought couldn't be, and at the end of the day, couldn't be permitted.
No, it could. We permitted it.
Oh, you did?
The Planning Commission did issue a permit for them,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so then I'm just confused for no reason. Okay.
Yeah, and they didn't end up going forward with it for other reasons, primarily to do with issues with the quota fund.
Okay, so it was about their business model, not about, okay.
Rob Seitz took his boat and went back up to Portland, I think, where he could fish the way he wanted to fish and get the quotas that he needed.
Yeah, I read that newsletter, and I guess I just got confused. Okay, then the other thing about that area, so we're saying that we don't want the boats for hire in that area, right? So theoretically, if they went away, we wouldn't let them back. So
correct, and then the joint sort of subcommittee that we have on the Harbor Advisory Board and Planning Commission, Joe is also a member of that. It's great that he's on this committee. And then we had the full joint meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board and Planning Commission, and that's they confirmed that. The idea is that once those things go away, they don't come back. We're not supposed to have recreational fishing boats in that location. That's sort of what Measure D says, but we sort of not followed that. That's the idea. If they do go away, that we don't put them back.
So I'm a big supporter, as I've said, of that, supporting that economy, right, and supportive of all that intent. Do we have capacity elsewhere in the bay for those uses to go?
We have available slips out there.
So they could. I mean, I'm just thinking of the overall economy. I'm just kind of a curiosity thing, but I just feel like they are uses that are appropriate in the overall area, right?
But absolutely. Yeah. In the joint Planning Commission and Harbor Advisory Board meeting, they concurred with that. They said yes, these are valuable services to have here, just not in the Measure D area. We do have properties that are redeveloping, and the slips will be added to those. We have several leases that are coming up right now in the near term. So we'll have additional dock space that gets developed as part of that. So we'll be even adding more dock space to the central area of the Embarcadero to accommodate more boats.
Okay, great. So and then just one other thing on this, because there's a few things on that section. When I read, because I was not born and raised here, I'll admit that, when I read Beach Street to Target Rock, I'm like, well, that's great, but I'm not totally sure specifically what we mean by that. So in some case, I mean, just there's not a ton of references, but I think when we talk about that area, it's just this common language that sort of everybody knows, but I guess I'm not in that category. And is it like the west side of Beach Street? Is it Beach Street to the ocean, not the east side? Where technically does that end?
It does go along the waterfront, and it does extend from Beach Street on the water side all the way up to Target Rock, which is kind of across from the parking lot at the rock, sort of. Kind of where the rock almost starts.
I never knew
what
that was.
See what I'm saying? Sort of, kind of, where the maybe.
Well, unless I put GPS locations on, I don't know how I can be more specific. Yeah, you'd be more specific. Target Rock is a thing.
Right.
Well, not the big thing.
I assume it is, but, is it all the – I figured it was. It's not on Google Maps, by the way. But –
you just said that. Now that'll be fixed. Somebody's gonna put that.
Right, they should. But it was not clear to me, all the, just precisely what land, because it seemed to me it would only be the coastal side for part of it, but then it would be both sides at the end, out there by the rock.
Scott, are we going to be bringing in some of the result of that process that's been happening to the next draft?
I owe that information to you. It's one of my
studies. So it's discussed here. We've been waiting for that process to play out with the subcommittee, and that will be brought in.
Yeah, I do have all that information for you.
Great. So a couple of questions. You said that end of the from Beach Street to Target Rock is not for recreational boat fishing boats. Are charter fishing boats, are they commercial boats, or are they recreational?
We're going to have this conversation. It's going to be fantastic. It does allow for recreational fishing boats, just not commercial recreational fishing boats. Those would be charter boats for fishing boats. So it doesn't allow for those. Yes, it doesn't.
So the charter fishing boats have to be somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Except the ones that are there now can
stay.
Okay. Then the other question is, where Virgis Landing is being, that how is that being put in there? If they're being redeveloped? Are they being enlarged, or are they taking up the same amount of the same footprint? Well, you know, as
Burgess Landing boats over by Giovanni's Fish Market.
No, I meant the property that where that new building is going in.
Oh,
Morro Bay Landing.
Morro Bay Landing.
Okay, Morro Bay Landing.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
It says in here that they cannot be enlarged or redeveloped.
Oh, okay. So I can answer that. So when the planning permit was approved for that Morro Bay Landing building to go in, and some of the existing buildings there will be demolished, the city council found that the tie boat building that's now occupied by Dockside 3, that square footage, which is like 900 and some square feet, that use could remain on site. So when Morro Bay Landing is constructed, and it'll be a two-story building there, the second story will have that exact 950 square foot restaurant use. So yes, Measure D says you can't have new restaurant uses and they can't expand. City Council found that because it was there on the site, they could allow that restaurant to remain. It just couldn't get any bigger.
So it's relocating, basically.
Like 30
well,
feet.
What is the downstairs of the building going to be? Is it going to be
it's Measure D, yeah, fishing sales and Measure D. Okay.
Tackle
compliant.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I kind of like the boat, but anyway. I wanted to just ask one more question about the power plant, because the cooling, the idea of cooling intake is really limited to, say, a natural gas or a fossil fuel plant. It's not wind or wave or some of the other things that are being discussed for the site or for the use of the property.
The idea is really just maintaining its sort of industrial type use, so we can use it for something else. So the zoning will reflect that.
What kind of industrial use would use an intake valve?
Don't know. Well, we actually, you know, you asked the question. I'll tell you.
Yeah. Okay.
I had a cosmetics company come forward that wanted to use
For sea salt or something like that.
Yeah, and they said, hey, could we use the intake? And we said, well, maybe depending on what you want to do. They're from Europe. They were going to come over here, and they needed a certain amount of salt water for their product.
Some of those around the Dead Sea, I think.
So, it was interesting. It was going to be a fairly large, employment generator as well. They were looking at several different locations, and so that was somebody that, I had never thought about that, but they needed access, and we were like, well,
but yeah. Doesn't this say power plant intake? I'm going to find it now. I've lost it. But I thought, is it power plant cooling water intake facilities? That's fairly specific. That doesn't seem to even tell me cosmetics production. at least maybe take the power plant off there and the cooling water, or just water intake facilities maybe, or just make it a little more general if that's the intent, is to maintain the ability to do that. Now, there are a lot of issues around entrainment and entrapment and other things, with once you're cooling, but I'm assuming that wouldn't necessarily be the same. I mean, you'd still have the intake issues around that.
Wouldn't they also need that if they did a nice big giant aquarium there? I mean, that was one of the things that you didn't want to lose that ability to cycle the water.
Well, not down all the way down there. I don't think you'd have to put it somewhere else.
If we put an aquarium down there. What if that building became an aquarium?
Okay. Well, then again, I think it ought to be just water intake and not power plant.
Not identified
water
as
intake.
The power plant.
Because isn't that the whole reason the power plant had to close? Is because we can't.
Was it once through cooling
plant,
and it was
right,
well, they could have retrofitted it, and there were some proposals to do that, but it was too expensive, and they weren't making any money, so I couldn't do it. But I think I understand. Okay, so let's say there is some use for water intake of some kind. Let's just take the power plant. It doesn't mean a power plant, I guess, if you could figure out how to do it, but that doesn't seem
we'll look at that. We'll look at the language. All that's right. Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's
very specific.
Just sort of suggest the location and the use and not identify it as a power plant.
Yeah, that would be power plant cooling water.
I do have a question about on page 42 where you talk about daycare. And I got a little confused as I was running through here, because I ran into family daycare on page 83 and daycare centers on page, those are PDF numbers. Pages 72 and 74 talk about two different kinds of daycare centers. Is this daycare here specifically for child care? Is that what it's about? That's what it looks like.
This one on 42 specifically talks about space for each child.
Yeah.
So I think it seems like that is intended to be children. Now, I suppose there could be adult daycare centers as well.
Yeah, there are.
Just a number of different kind of daycare things here.
daycare does include adult daycare as well.
Then it shouldn't talk about outdoor space for child. It should be for each attendee or each person or something like that. Is that each child who is not an infant? Well, okay, there's a could be a person who's not an infant. I don't know.
But right.
Yeah, I think if there's first of all in two different places, you should explain why. But also, if you're intended to. If they're intended to be anybody, it should be anybody.
But I wonder if they have the requirements for outdoor spaces for adult daycare attendees that they do for children. Because there's definitely, I know there's a regulation that requires you to have a certain amount of outside space for kids in a daycare home or daycare center. But I don't know that there is that for adults.
Yeah, and this talks about a public park or a school or other public areas. I mean, it seemed like children need a place to play. Adults might also need some place. Like I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a good question.
Yeah. And then later you have a definition on daycare centers, I believe it is, that refers to more supervisory kinds of activities where you might have a licensed home nurse or something helping to take care of people during the day. And I don't know how those standards all interact. This is one of those cases where there's a lot of cross-referencing that I couldn't quite follow.
And truthfully, it is even difficult for us to parse it all out because there are a number of things, some of which are, again, established per state law, including the home daycare, mm-hmm. the small and the large, as well as residential care facilities and so on.
And then those interact with the districts that they can exist in. So it's really a pretty complex matrix of different things that are daycare here.
Right. And we try and make it as separate and discrete as possible, but there are just some things that just by the nature of everything that we're putting together makes it complex.
Okay. I guess it's just the daycare word needs to be carefully thought out. You might want to use different words to describe those so that they really refer to the market or use that they can be.
We try to, but then some we do need to match up with state law and other regulations. Otherwise, that gets confusing on that side. So, it's
not to get too far in the weeds with daycare, but isn't a wall height usually a huge issue? And I feel like it refers to the necessity of a wall and its 75% opacity. But isn't the height of a wall tightly regulated for a daycare facility? It is not referred to, so.
I don't know about the heights. If it is, that would be something that the state or the licensing board would be checking on the height of the walls for. As far as the city's concerned with heights and walls, they would have to meet the fence height standards.
Standard.
I have a question on page, if we could just move on for a little, page 45 about 17 section B where it talks about the 36-bed dormitory style housing for agricultural workers. So I'm trying to understand. So in an agricultural district, employees up to 36 who do not work on the property where the employee housing is located. So my question is how could you build a 36-bed dormitory on agricultural land that's not the site of the agricultural workers' employment?
I think it's I helped write this section a couple years ago. So this is from state law, first of all, and it just means that you can't require that the person who lives there has to only work on that property, because people do work at more than one place sometimes, and also one larger farm could have a dormitory in one location, but they might have multiple fields that they farm, so that kind of thing.
So you can in fact build a dormitory, which is a fairly dense kind of structure, on agricultural land.
That is state law.
Different issue. It also caught my eye that I thought it was odd to permit single unit dwelling detached units in certain places, and neighborhood commercial jumped out at me. It just seemed odd to imagine single family detached housing in neighborhood commercial. Is that odd? Maybe it's not odd. That just caught
Is that part eye. Of that maybe front unit, back unit?
Right.
Issue?
Okay.
Is that what you're talking
All
about?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Then that wouldn't be odd. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We actually just recently had an example of that right across from City Hall, where you have that sort of mixed use thing going on with the commercial in the front.
They built a house in the back.
They wanted to tear down the front thing and build a house there, and I said no.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, right. I mean, I guess it wouldn't be necessarily a preference to me that it'd be detached, but I guess I can see in this setting how it would happen.
Yeah, it's just the same as any other single-family home.
I guess so, yeah. Is it, and then it also caught my eye that campgrounds are not conditionally permitted in open space designation. It would seem to me that you'd conditionally permit campgrounds in open space areas. I mean, at least conditionally, if not.
Right. Well, no, because the open space district is specifically intended for open space and undeveloped parkland, natural resource areas. If there is somewhere where you're going to put a campground, that should be designated park and recreation facilities.
Hmm.
So, and that's one of the things to... You know, in thinking of, because you are doing the general plan at the same time, those land use designations are where it's open space, it's really is imagined open space and not.
I mean, I do, and I see what you're saying. I just view that as an accessory type use that it is very consistent with open space. That seems like it could be allowed in an open space designation. But, I mean, I get it. I get what open space is, but... Anyway, that just jumped out at me as strange. It also jumped out at me as strange, but maybe this is very common in code, that cemeteries are conditionally permitted in parks and rec land. So is that just the most common thing in the world? But I just thought if we have land that's designated for parks and rec, I think we want it to be parks and rec, not necessarily cemeteries. So I just thought that was odd and eye-catching. And is that just a carryover? Is what we've done, or is that typical?
You know, truthfully, I'm not sure if that's a carryover. I don't know. But we can look at those lands, and if they're not...
I've seen it elsewhere, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know actually how common that is.
I just don't. It's just striking me strange.
I remember seeing it when I read through it before, but I'd seen other codes that had it, and I just didn't really think about it. But it might not be that common. I don't know.
I will add, when it comes to cemeteries, there is some interesting state law on where they can be located.
Mm.
And I've spoken with cemetery owners in the past who were looking at land in Morro Bay to open up a cemetery,
mm-hmm.
Because cemeteries do get full. And I had a very long, interesting conversation, and he explained all sorts of state laws and they can even put cemeteries in residential uses. So don't know if that answers your question, but I found it very enlightening. And obviously he never chose to build because here we are, you know, years later, and there's no cemetery.
I agree that really it should be for the use of live people.
Parks and Rec, I just feel like it's hard to come by, and I just don't,
yeah,
I don't think
definitely.
They're interchangeable, you know. But
when I was a preschool teacher, I used to take the kids to the cemetery for picnics and field trips and stuff. And in Santa Cruz, they were beautiful, and they had, you know, rambling roses, and they were really fun.
There's a lot of cemeteries that are,
yeah,
you know, beautiful.
Yeah,
and
I like
gorgeous
cemeteries.
And
yeah,
but whatever, but yeah.
I just find it odd. So one last thing. The height change, so we talked about height change, proposed height change, and in the selected sites in the downtown area, I'm all for that. How does the height districts that we're talking about relate to the catalytic sites that we talked about in the downtown plan? Because it seems like some of those sites would be...
Some of them are there. Some of them are not. When we looked at the areas where we wanted to go to 37 feet, and when we had the input from GPAC and from the public through our engagement process in workshops and whatnot, there was a desire to consider it and to go down the road, but maybe not put it everywhere. And so we put it along the main commercial corridors because it seemed to make the most sense there. And when you looked at it, it probably would have the least impact to adjacent properties from the standpoint of views and that type of thing. So that's kind of where that area came from.
I had a question about sort of back to the accessory dwelling units. I noticed that there was a provision in here that requires, if somebody has one, to apply for some kind of for a permit for a acceptance certificate by some certain date. And I'm.
That's if you have an existing one. So it's sort of a.
Yeah, but let's say you buy a place and there's a unit there that wasn't accepted, whatever that is. It seems like you'd want to be maybe in compliance and be able to come in and get that. Is it not possible to do that?
You would be subject to the requirements of the ordinance is all. I mean, so like, if you have an existing one and maybe it's not totally compliant, but you have one, then we can accept it in because it was built under different requirements or
right.
what have you. And because they're a positive thing. We want to have them and we want to encourage them.
Yeah, and you want to make sure that they are compliant to the extent they should be. But
right.
I guess the way this was written to me, it seems to say that if you didn't apply by a certain time, then you couldn't. There's a date. Some date's going to go in here. That says you have to apply by this certain time, and
well,
then
this would be for ones that don't comply with the current ordinance.
Okay, this just says acceptance of existing dwelling units, and it says that they on a lot that includes the required number of parking spaces and is exempt from the unit size and design requirements. Okay, so what does somebody do if they own a place or if they maybe they bought it a while ago? I mean, I guess I'm sort of wondering how do you come back into compliance? You have to fix it somehow or.
I mean, if we don't have the clause in here, then someone comes in. How we find these out? You come in and, at some point a house is going to get remodeled,
okay.
typically, right? You come in and then we're looking at the plans and they show the remodel of this thing in the back. We have no records of it. We're like, what's that? Like, that's our secondary unit that we're remodeling. We're like, no, it's not. It's not permitted. Our ordinance came into play here. You don't have a permitted unit. And so what is that? Okay, well, we have to look at our ordinance. You want to make an accessory dwelling unit, you need to comply with all these things, and that doesn't comply.
Okay, so if it doesn't comply, they're not allowed to remodel it? Do they have to tear it down? I mean, what happens?
Well, you lose the use. If you have existing nonconforming use or one that's not permitted or illegally permitted, then you have a problem. And we find ones all the time that are out there that people have converted over time. It's good that the parameters that are inside of our existing ordinance are fairly lenient in getting them permitted.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually there's not issues, but sometimes there are.
If they had applied by a certain date, you would have accepted them. Just the fact that they didn't apply by that date, even though you could show it was there before, it seems a little arbitrary not to accept them. And you would want to, I would think, encourage people to modernize those things, especially, I don't know. Anyway, I'm just wondering about the date cutoff, It just seems...
It sort of gives a grace, when you put it in, you put a grace period in to allow people to come in. And then in doing that, what you do is once we adopt the ordinance, then we go out there through a mailer, through your utility bills, and send them to everybody so they know, okay, you got a couple of years to get this in, even if yours isn't compliant with, say, setback requirements and stuff like that, because we have a lot of bootleg things out there.
I know. There's a lot of weird stuff.
And some things we can bring in and get permitted, and some things can't be secondary or accessory dwelling units because they don't meet setbacks or what have you, and so they can't do it. This would say, hey, you might have a non-conforming one, but we'll get you, we'll bring you in, but at some point you're going to have to comply.
This encourages people not to tell you. This encourages people basically to just not remodel them and not do anything to them because you're going to, if they're, I don't know if they're
rental units. They already weren't doing that.
Okay.
They weren't letting us know.
Okay, but you know what I'm saying is I think you'd want to, if they weren't in compliance for every reason, you'd want to encourage them to at least tell you that it's there. And if it's their health and safety or other issues, you could at least address them. I don't know. I wonder if it's not counterproductive to say, if we know about it, if you tell us about it, you're going to be punished.
So I've done this two times now because the secondary unit ordinance over time has changed several times, and there's more legislation in place now coming forward. So it's going to be even different moving forward potentially. But because it's changed so many times, I've had the opportunity to work my way through these, and putting in grandfathering clauses to allow them to come in has made sense, because once the thing gets adopted, you have to comply. And what it says you have to comply with oftentimes is setbacks and things like that. So somebody comes in, it doesn't comply, they never had permits for it, they can't have it. So if we have this thing that says, you can come in, we have a little grace period for you, and let everybody know that it's 24 months or whatever it is, that's kind of what it does.
Okay, so if they miss that deadline, though, you basically encourage them not to do anything with it, even if they could upgrade it. I'm just wondering about it. So I know we're getting running low on time.
If it was permitted, or yeah, exactly.
So. We are up against the clock.
Yeah.
Any closing comments from members?
All right, I'll be very brief. My usual statement with respect to telecommunications, I saw the provision in the zoning code where it cites the ability to bring in a third-party outside consultant for co-location. There are so many provisions in that part that talk about feasibility. I would like to see that ability, the discretion of the City Council or the Planning Commission to bring it in with respect to location, with respect to design, with respect to the other category as well. The reason I say that is because typically Verizon or AT&T comes to us with their division supervisor and their public relations person and their engineer, and they present us with a fait accompli of, we want a new telecommunication installation and here are three locations, and choose between those. And we on the board, the commission, don't have the technical ability to properly vet that, so we're essentially relying on the technical presentation of the applicant. Now, I'm not suggesting that they're dishonest. I'm not doing that. But facts are susceptible to being massaged. They're malleable. And it's a little bit akin to allowing one of the big three auto manufacturers to decide on what exhaust standards should be. I think we should be able to go to a third-party source.
Thanks, Joe. That was a huge area that I just kind of glazed over, because it was like, well, I know nothing about this.
We've had lots of conversations about this with the applications going before the Planning Commission, so certainly if you want to write down some of your comments to us, that'd be great. I'd like to have that, if you wouldn't mind doing that.
There's one new tower. I wondered if the city was subject to these rules, because there's one new tower that went in where the police station is or something like that, where there's this giant, huge tower that went in, but way higher than the height limits, I thought. I was just wondering how that. I know we're running up against time, but that seemed
they decided they were going to put it in because they needed it for communication purposes.
So that's not subject to height limits or anything else.
Yeah, I mean, they're emergency services, so
I want to have emergency services, so
they have dead spot. They've had in the past. They've had dead spots in the city, so I know that the new antenna was meant to address that, but they didn't really.
I'm sure it's got a wide range.
We had dead spots in the city, which can be dangerous for emergency response folks. So, yeah. Supposed to improve that, I believe.
Any closing comments from our panel here?
I have one. Since we've reduced the size of this board, do you like sitting down and meeting like this still, or do you want to be up on the thing? Kind of up to you. I just realized that now you could all fit up there if you wanted to be there. Thought process.
I feel like we're on a level with all of our audience, okay. And this is fine.
Because there's a lot of back and forth. It's nicer from staff standpoint to be sitting here across from you. But okay, all right. Just an issue that came up and someone raised it. I said, well, I'll ask them. So,
okay. Anybody else? Thank you so much for all your hard work. We will adjourn this meeting until May 17th at 4:00 here in the Veterans Building. Thank you.